This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor of Yes Magazine, to talk about deeper shifts changing our world. Coming up next, right after this announcement.
KBOO Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater presents a monthly film series on the second Thursday of each month. January 10th at 7 p.m., we present the 1988 film Talk Radio, in which a rude, contemptuous talk show host becomes overwhelmed by the hatred that surrounds his program just before it goes national.
Open your mouth and tell them what we're going to do about the mess this country's in. Talk radio. It's the last neighborhood in town. People just don't talk to each other anymore. Let's go to the first caller. Night Talk.
Before the film, we'll hear Carl Wolfson, who will talk about his experience as a talk show host in Portland. And the film will be introduced by a KBOO board member and Wednesday morning talk show host, Lisa Loving. That's January 10th at the Clinton Street Theater at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboofilms.
Good morning. It is 5 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, and you are listening to Positively Revolting on your very own community radio station, KBOO Portland. This is your community radio station. I'm Ani, and I'm your, well, singular host this morning of Positively Revolting as our dear friend Lynn is off enjoying the wilds of the Oregon coast. So, I welcome you to the program, and I also am excited to say that my guest this morning is Sarah Van Gelder, who is the co-founder and executive director of Yes Magazine. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning to you, Ani.
It's wonderful to have you back on. You are, in fact, the editor of Yes Magazine, executive editor, also the editor of the book, This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement, which is, I think, what you were talking about the last time you were on this program. You are also a regular blogger for Yes Magazine and Huffington Post, writer of many articles and op-eds, and, well, just you're an all-round writing-informed kind of gal. So thank you very much for joining us this morning, Sarah.
Glad to be here.
I don't know about you. I'm just going to jump straight into things here. I get really excited at the beginning of Gregorian New Year. There's something about tearing off the December page of the calendar, you know, and seeing this fresh new year ahead of us. And it seems like the air is always ripe with opportunities and possibilities and what we can move forward and do this year, accomplish together. And you've recently written an article called 9 Stories That Will Change Your World in 2013. And the article uses past as prologue to put together the puzzle of what it's likely to unfold before us in this coming year. So I want to look at how we can use this information to see the currents and to try to start off this year with a little analysis about where things are trending, as we say, mm-hmm. and how we can really keep momentum going on so many critical issues that came to light in this last year, starting with the environment and looking at Sandy, the Frankenstorm. Let's go ahead and start there. When we're looking at big stories, it's hard to imagine a bigger story, really, than much of the East Coast being shut down and the flooding that we saw in New York and New Jersey. Let's go ahead and start talking about the climate crisis and what Hurricane Sandy teaches us.
Yeah, I actually had an opportunity to spend a day volunteering with Occupy Sandy in Far Rockaway, which is one of the beach communities that was overwhelmed by the ocean during that huge superstorm. And it is quite extraordinary just, you know, how widespread the damage is, how many acres of land are just now in question as to whether people can actually live there anymore because of rising sea levels and because the climate models all predict more and more of these storms. You know, there's more energy in the global atmosphere. There's more energy in the ocean with the temperature rising, and that just means that those storms are going to be something that people are going to have to learn to live with. So I think that one of the things that happened last year is that was the sort of culmination of a whole series of real major climate catastrophes, the drought that took place across the country. I believe it was more than half of the counties in the United States were declared disaster zones because of the level of drought.
Yeah.
And you had farmers all over there. I mean, the drama was perhaps more diffuse because it was spread out over such a wide territory. But farmers all over the country going bankrupt because they simply weren't getting the rain that they need to grow their crops. And then out here in the West Coast, of course, we had a lot of wildfires going on and something like 9 million acres burned. So the climate impact is hitting right now. I think many of us might have thought that this would happen decades from now. Maybe it was something other people or future generations would have to deal with, but it's something that we are having to deal with right now. And I think that has really shifted public opinion. The people who weren't willing to believe the projections of the climate scientists, the 98% of climate scientists who all agree that this is an issue, are more willing to, evidently according to the polling, are more willing to believe their own eyes and their own experience and say, yeah, this is serious and we really do have to act.
What sort of actions, I mean, you know, as we look forward to this year ahead, keeping climate change and the obvious repercussions of that, you know, in the front of our consciousness, seems very important. What sort of groups, what sort of actions are you seeing coming up that are addressing this issue effectively?
You know, as many times happens, when something really basic has to change, when there's some really major, major shifts that have to happen, they're not going to happen from the top down. They're not going to be the established political order or the established commercial, you know, business world that is going to initiate them. Those changes are going to come from the grassroots mm-hmm. up. And I think that's what we're seeing right now in terms of dealing with these major energy, fossil fuel energy questions. So one of the things I wrote about in my column that's at yesmagazine.org is about how much of the real action is taking place at the grassroots, how much is coming from people like Bill McKibben and 350.org, who are organizing young people around the country and actually alumni to go to the university, to their universities and encourage them to divest from the big oil and coal corporations. So just like in when we had apartheid in South Africa, the divestment movement was part of what shifted global public opinion and shifted where investment was going to happen away from the apartheid system. We need to be doing the same thing now in terms of really making clear that these big fossil fuel energy corporations who have been so destructive both in their practices but also in their politics, in keeping the climate issue off the political agenda, that we really need to take on those corporations through their pocketbooks. So that this is a brand new initiative in 2012, which I think will be spreading. They launched their national campaign here in Seattle, and they filled up Benaroya Hall, which is a rather large symphony hall. Just about 2,000 people were there to hear a lecture about climate change. And you know what it reminded me of is that same hall was where the first teach-in took place when the WTO came to Seattle back in 1999. And they filled that hall as well with a lot of activists just wanting to really understand the issues so they could be involved in the WTO protests that took place, as you may remember, back in 1999.
I do indeed.
Yeah, so this, you know, just seeing that kind of popular energy just filling the hall with people who are just ready to take action. And then, of course, Bill McKibben and his team have been going out across the country with similar efforts elsewhere. And then for here in the Northwest, I think a particularly important question is whether we're going to allow this plan to transport Powder River coal from Wyoming through ports in our region for export to China. Again, here in Seattle, that's a huge issue, but I believe in Portland as well, you're going to have some ability to weigh in on whether you want those trains, those huge coal trains coming through Oregon.
Absolutely. The coal trains issue is huge, not only in Portland, but in the surrounding areas as well, up the Columbia River, you know, where, again, we would be seeing these trains with carrying their coal dust. Let's look also at the economy over this last year. I was heartened towards the end of the year as Walmart workers started to, well, make a lot of noise about their conditions and organize. So let's look there for a moment.
Yeah, you know, I think that is a really hopeful sign. The people who are at the bottom of the wage scale in this country, who work sometimes several jobs to try to put together enough hours to make ends meet, who, you know, this notion of a working poor that we've come to accept, that people should work that many hours and still not be able to afford to support a family, I think that notion is really in question. And the Walmart workers deserve a lot of credit for their courage, because the Walmart Corporation has been very, very strict and very, very aggressive about pushing back on any efforts to unionize. So yes, I think that basic right of earning a living wage and getting enough benefits like health insurance that you can actually expect to have some stability for your family, I think that idea is very much on the national agenda, and I think we'll be seeing more of that in the coming year.
And again, I think one of the things to me that is really going to be essential here is is turning around horizontal hostility. A lot of times, you know, what I hear from people who have perhaps a little bit better situation, a little bit a job that's a little more lucrative, is there's a lack of empathy about what it really means to work in conditions like Walmart or Amazon .com or, you know, these sort of American sweatshop sort of ideas. There's little understanding about what the conditions of work are in those places, or how very little workers are paid. How do we increase understanding and empathy between the middle classes and the working poor?
Well, I think part of it is getting really clear on where the problem is, you know, because I think I agree with you, and I think it also goes the other way, where people like Governor Scott Brown in Wisconsin was trying to blame public employees for bankrupting the state.
Exactly.
Because they had pensions that were actually going to give them a middle class standard of living rather than poverty in their elderhood. You know,
exactly.
I mean, so both ways, I mean, the notion that either the low-wage workers or the middle-class workers who worked really hard for those pensions are to blame is just, you know, flawed, because what's really to blame is a system that is systematically extracting wealth from the 99% and sending it through various means, which we could talk about, you know, everything from debt to the way the banking system is structured, is sending that money right up to the 1%. So that's really the problem, and we just have to keep that front and center and not be swayed by these arguments. I think what happens is when a group of people are feeling powerless against some group as powerful as the 1%, they figure, well, we won't be able to take on that power structure, so let's turn on the people who maybe we can take on, and those people end up being people who are equally or more powerless than themselves. We've really got to avoid that. I mean, that's so much where a lot of the racism comes from, I think, as well, is you know, a group of white workers, for example, who believe that they need to defend their jobs by reducing immigration or by penalizing people of color. That whole technique has kept us from making progress on so many fronts.
Oh, yeah. Let's actually explore that a little bit. when it comes to the divide and conquering, that's still really winning for the elite right now. There's a lot of scapegoating, especially as, and this is another one of the stories that you mentioned, as our demographics change as a nation. It, to me, I'm feeling, or we're actually seeing, that folks who are used to having the privilege, and I'll go ahead and say, you know, straight white guys of a certain age and class, are kind of, you know, reacting not so well to the inclusivity factor, right? To the idea that, you know, maybe in theory, sure, we want to include everyone in all this, but when it comes right down to it, well, you know, that's taking away from me. That's taking away from what I already have, so we don't have enough for you. You know, sort of mentality. Again, looking for ways to get through that, to try to get the idea of solidarity, class solidarity, and anti-racist efforts, anti-sexist efforts out there. What do you see as hopeful possibilities?
Well, I think that was what you described is what the Republican strategy was, and I think it very clearly failed. And it failed for several reasons, one of which is that the demographics have shifted so mm-hmm. that the percentage of our voting population that is white, affluent, and male and straight is smaller now. And it failed because I think there are a lot of people who are just really turned off by the radical right-wing stances that mm-hmm. seem to condone rape, but, you know, not condone women having any control over their bodies and, you know,
right.
vilify gays and so forth. I think a lot of people were simply turned off by that. So that's the good news, is that Republican Party strategy, I think they recognize as having failed, particularly on the question of immigration rights, because I think they are recognizing that the Latino population is an important enough voting bloc that they can't continue to disparage them in quite the way that they had. So whether or not they've had a change of heart or just a change of strategy. I think probably the latter. So that's the good news, is that the Republican Party is really having to reassess what it wants to do. Another part of the good news is that I think part of that strategy involved voter suppression, because if you could keep enough of the people who were going to vote against you away from the polls, then you could still prevail. And although that strategy we saw play out in different states in different ways, but the tenacity of people who were going to vote, regardless of how long those lines were, the tenacity that they had, especially again in poor and communities and people of color communities, they got in lines and they waited for many hours in many cases and voted. Mm-hmm. So those voter suppression tactics, for the most part, failed. On the other hand, we haven't seen the end of it. That the Supreme Court's going to be looking at the Voting Rights Act and could overturn it. And some of those same techniques of voter suppression will no doubt show up again in 2 years at the next election. So we can't be complacent about voter suppression. So that said, I think the fact that we have more women in Congress than we've ever had, that we have people who are gay and out in Congress, mm-hmm. those are really great signs. And I think that those kinds of things are going to shift the political culture in Washington, D.C., as well as around the country.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani, and my guest this morning is Sarah Van Gelder. She's the co-founder and executive director of Yes Magazine, also the author of the recent article, 9 Stories That Will Shape Your New Year. I know I'm paraphrasing the title of that article, but we'll move through that right about now. You are welcome to call into the program with your questions. I'd love to hear from our listeners about what they think are important issues that they'll continue to follow this year and work on this year, where their priorities are as social change activists, because I know our listening audience is full of social change activists by many, many stripes, whether that's a person who is talking to their neighbors about the world that we need to shift into, or somebody who has taken it to the streets. Whatever your situation, we'd love to hear from you. Call on in with your comments, your questions at 503-231-8187. Also, I want to remind folks you can like Positively Revolting on Facebook and be a part of the conversation throughout the week. That's going to Facebook and searching Positively Revolting, hitting the little like button. You can also contact myself and or Lynn anytime by email at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. So, looking at one more thing I wanted to throw in there before our first caller, looking at the climate change, looking at solidarity, looking at trying to lift up all people, brings me to Occupy, right? And this is another one of the big stories of 2012. Now, mainstream media would tell us Occupy is dead, mm-hmm. but that's certainly not the case. And in fact, in Sandy, we saw Occupy coming to the fore in some pretty wonderful ways. What's your take on Occupy over this last year, and where it's going?
Well, as most social movements do, it's been evolving. I think you're right that the mainstream media has thought it went away because the encampments, by and large, went away. But as Marina Citrin says, she's one of the people who were there from the early days and sort of a philosopher of the movement. She says Occupy is a verb, not a noun. It's what you do, and it's an attitude, and it's how you approach things. And that is very much alive and kicking. And I was so struck by how it's become sort of reemerged in a really powerful way this fall, partly through strike debt, which was acknowledging that, a lot of the people who were involved in Occupy right from the beginning were involved because of debt, because of student debt, because they were overwhelmed. People were overwhelmed when they left college and they had tens of thousands of dollars in debt, or because of medical debt, because someone, gets sick, and even though they may have insurance, it still leaves them, bankrupt or nearly bankrupt with the amount of debt they have, or people who bought homes and ended up with bad mortgages. debt has been so much a part of what has been taking apart the prospects for middle class life. So they decide to really take that on as a question and began a process that I think is particularly interesting, this rolling jubilee, mm-hmm. which was aimed at dissolving thousands of dollars of debt. So they thought, you know, suppose we acted like a collection agency, you know, and we bought the debt from the hospitals, but instead of, you know, and collection agencies buy the debt for, you know, pennies on the dollar. So suppose we did that. We bought this debt for pennies on the dollar, but instead of harassing people to get them to pay up some percentage of it, we dissolve it. So that's what they did. Yeah. They raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, mm-hmm. and they're dissolving millions of dollars of medical debt that individuals would otherwise be owing.
It's a beautiful and simple idea, you know. To me, that was one of the more inspiring stories of 2012, and looking at how we can actually use the system to alleviate the suffering of so many if we're just a little bit more creative in how we think about things. I want to go ahead and give Sean an opportunity to chime in. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Good morning. I really appreciate the conversation. This is the only place that we can have this conversation. I wanted to address something that I've noticed in Yes Magazine. It seems like there's a kind of fetishizing of small business entrepreneurial culture. I'm noticing a kind of really upsetting narrative out there. It's along the lines of Mitt Romney's 47% argument. And it's this kind of small business mentality where people, it's like this whole idea of the poor, beleaguered small businessman. You've got the parasites on the bottom, you know, the 47%. And then you've got the plutocrats on the top, which is a really frightening narrative. I think it was the small business petty bourgeois community that made up the fascist movements in Europe during the last Great Depression. And so I was hoping to address this notion on the left that entrepreneurialism and small business is somehow a progressive force. I don't get that at all. I think they're the most reactionary right-wing people that I ever come across. And the last thing I want to do is descend into some sort of juvenile macho posturing, but it has to be pointed out that in South Africa, you had people like Chris Hani and Joe Slovo, you know, the ANC, the Communist Party of South Africa. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just divestment. There, you know, I can't see how we get around this notion of having a vanguard party that puts forth an agenda of eliminating capitalism and eliminating imperialism. Instead we wound up sounding evasive and oblique. Can't we just put this out on the table and have an honest discussion about it? Thanks.
Thanks very much. I mean, I know I personally would love to put out on the table, let's end capitalism. You know, this year, next year, now, last month, that would be a fine and beautiful idea for me. But what do you have to say, Sarah, about the idea of small businesses? If I'm hearing from Sean, he's suspect at best of the idea that small businesses are helpful or a way to go.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time at Yes thinking about a new economy for the United States that can evolve from the economy that we have now and that could actually win public opinion and win the power to actually make the shift. In our view, actually, our coming issue is going to be on a cooperative economy, because our view is actually that ownership matters a lot and that the ideal economy is probably one in which there's as diverse a system of ownership as there are in ecosystems, mm-hmm. but that the power is bottom up. So, you know, we think that would be some combination of cooperatives, and as I mentioned, this next issue is going to be all about cooperatives in terms of credit unions, in terms of worker-owned enterprises, in terms of producer-owned enterprises. So all the different kinds of cooperatives that distribute power to ordinary people. Small businesses is another form of bottom-up power. I spent some time in Cuba, actually. My article on their healthcare system is at yesmagazine.org. But one of the things I noticed there is that they don't allow small business. And so when there's a need, you know, if people would like to have a little restaurant down the street and there's somebody who's a good cook, they can't put that together. They can't just say, somebody can't just say, you know what, I can make, you know, really great food in my kitchen and serve it, you know, on the street in front of my house at little tables, and you could come along and buy it. People are not allowed to do that. And I actually think that kind of bottom-up creative enterprise is actually a really productive part of a thriving, diverse, creative economy. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at, is how do we... The thing that I think we're probably in agreement with, Sean, is that the large corporations, the large transnational corporations, Wall Street, the way that our entire economy has shifted to benefit shareholders, to benefit international finance, those kinds of things are just intrinsically destructive. They're really shifting the power away from ordinary people. They're shifting the entire agenda of our society, if you will, mm-hmm. to how do we grow the economy in order to make huge profits for the 1%. And what, you know, we will destroy anything in the path of doing that, including our environment, our prospects for our children, you know, our workers who are injured on the job because there's not sufficient regulation, because the 1% are able to exert enough power to get the regulations taken away. So there's so many reasons why that big corporate capitalist system is destroying people and the planet that I think we would be in agreement with Sean about the destructiveness of that. But we're really interested in what do we put in its place, and mm-hmm. our view about what we put in its place is very much a bottom-up kind of diverse democratic economy.
I know I, for one, would love to have more conversations this next year about how to, you know, get over the capitalist economy that is upon us, and what place entrepreneurialism has in that new economy. I think that that's a very productive discussion that is happening, but let's have it more. Let's have more of those discussions.
I agree. That's great.
Let's talk to Kelly on the line. Good morning, Kelly. You're on the air.
Good morning, I'm Kelly, and thanks for taking us on the wonderful conversation and work that you're doing.
Thank you.
So the issue that I think is one of the most important is a variety of food security issues, from fighting Monsanto and GMOs to looking at how farm workers are treated and the screwy government appropriations of farm assistance and organic issues. There's just so many pieces to the food system issues, and that's one of the things I'm active in.
Oh, I completely agree with you, Kelly. I think those are huge. And I really like the way you put together the question of GMOs and the kinds of food that we eat and what that does to our bodies with the question of the people who are producing that food for us. Because I think often those two get separated. We have worker rights organizing going on over here, and we have good food and organics and GMOs over there. And really, it's all connected. And if you put all that together, you realize that the worst jobs in our society are those food system jobs, from farm workers all the way through food processors and meatpacking plants to restaurant workers. Those are the worst jobs, and we should not tolerate jobs that have such low wages and such poor working conditions. So I actually went to a workshop on the possibilities for how those two movements could come together. Good food, I think they're calling it good food, good jobs movement, to try to bring those two issues together so that that we can all work on those issues together.
I really feel that there's a lack of attention in the movement regarding the fact that GMOs basically equal an increase in pesticide and therefore an increase in exposure to those who are doing the farm work. That's really missing from the dialogue, by and large.
Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point. I mean, I think, again, people tend to think of the GMOs in terms of the effects on their own health if they eat, you know, corn that basically has a pesticide built into the genetic structure now. You know, that's a health issue. But you're absolutely right. It also means that the farmers can use even more pesticides and that the farm workers are suffering as a result. So I agree with you.
Just yesterday in Jackson County, a lot of the organic farmers had a big petition. I think they got over 6,700 signatures, which in Jackson County is not a small feat, fighting genetically engineered beets and other invasion of GM plants. And we're having the same types of challenges up here in the Willamette Valley around canola.
Interesting.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Kelly.
One last thing. OneBillionRising.org. I'd love to hear what she has to say about the movement of women against violence. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Sarah, have you been looking at what's going on with One Billion Rising?
You know, that's familiar, but I don't know. Okay. I haven't followed it closely, but I do think that this is a pretty extraordinary moment for women's rights and women pushing back against violence. Of course, in India, that's especially striking with what's happening right now in terms of the horrible gang rape that happened in New Delhi.
Right.
But it's also, the Violence Against Women Act is also up for approval in Congress, and there's a major piece of it that the tribes are very concerned about that has to do with protecting Native American women on reservations here in this country. So, yeah, very, very important moment for that question.
We will be looking at One Billion Rising in a show coming soon. It is a movement of women, primarily of everyone, to end violence against women. This, I think, really got underway last year with that perfect storm of the war on women, basically. The incredibly, see, I start getting apoplectic, I can't even like form words anymore, the attitudes that were brought forth by, you know, Aikens and Limbaugh and, you know, elected officials and pundits together in their expression of contempt for women and our control over our bodies. So this is one of the reactions to that. There is major actions planned for February 14th. So we'll be looking at that for sure in one of the weeks ahead. So let's go ahead and take our next caller. I want to remind people you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. My name is Ani. This is Positively Revolting. Every week, every Friday morning, 8 a.m., we come to you and look at the new world that we want to co-create together while decrying the world that we are currently in, looking at how we can take positive steps together to make this place so much better than we found it. How's that? And today, I'm very fortunate to have as my guest, Sarah Van Gelder. She is the co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine. And you just write the best articles, Sarah. I'm always so happy to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. If you would like to join in this conversation, you can do so by calling us at 503-231-8187 and let us know where you want to focus your attention in 2013, what you are looking forward to in this year ahead politically, socially, where you are putting your priorities for social change this year. Let's go ahead and talk to Lynn right now. Good morning, Lynn. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ani. I wanted to respond when somebody was talking about corporations. And the thing that I'm interested in is B corporations. That stands for benefit. And it's taking capitalism to the next step instead of just having the shareholders getting the benefits, looking at all stakeholders getting the benefits of corporations. And I'm a new person to this idea, so I don't have a lot to say about it, but I just wanted to get that out there. B corporations for benefit corporations.
Okay. Thanks very much, Lynn.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think those are great innovations. You know, I think this is all part of this really exciting period we're in, where people are looking for alternative structures and ownership structures. I think the old idea that we're just going to get the big corporations that are publicly traded and on Wall Street, and everybody, you know, where the shareholders are looking for the highest return, to get them to be socially responsible, I think is a flawed idea. But the B corporations, I think, actually do have that potential, because they structure in the notion that they need to provide benefits to the larger community, to more than the financial bottom line. So I do think that, you know, from what I've been able to tell, that those are an important step forward.
Absolutely. Let's look a little bit at the U.S. Let's look abroad. One of the stories that you mention in your article is the U.S. global military posture and how that is now being perceived. You know, you write, pursuing the most globally aggressive military posture on the planet is causing a level of blowback little discussed in mainstream media. So let's discuss that now. What are you seeing in terms of reaction to U.S. hegemony and imperialism abroad?
Well, there's so many aspects to this. Just one.
I know we only have another 20 minutes, but it's true. Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah. So just one is the drone attacks. Which. You know, on the one hand, perhaps they're more politically popular in the U.S. because they don't put American service members at risk. On the other hand, they are killing civilians. They're terrifying.
It really strikes me as the video gameization of war. Where our military personnel are absolutely remote, absolutely disconnected, and pushing buttons to go off and kill people in very surgical strikes that may or may not be targeted well.
That's right. There's always going to be mistakes. There's always going to be innocent civilians who are killed for no reason except that someone made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a form of terror when innocent civilians are killed and terrorized by these kinds of military operations. And there's blowback from that. That is not how you win the hearts and minds of a people. You know, I just heard on the radio this morning there was a bomb discovered. I believe it was in someplace in the middle in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict area, but I don't remember because I just heard it briefly on the radio. But it was because a local person gave a tip that they found it. It's because when the ordinary people are on your side and trying to create peace and working with you to create peace, then you start winning peace. When you create enemies out of every single civilian around you, you will never win peace. You just won't. I mean, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union Empire, was defeated by the Afghans. We will be defeated too if we simply continue this idea that we can just kill and terrorize our way to victory. We will not.
So for years, many, many years, for as long as the occupation of Afghanistan has been around, we've been saying, no, stop this, bring the troops home. How do you see this gaining any momentum? How do you see this actually, the anti-war movement, the movement for global peace, where do you see that gaining traction this year?
I think our biggest opportunity this year is really to look at the financial question. Because now that the first phase of the fiscal cliff discussion has passed, the next phase is going to be on spending cuts. And I think it's a very important time to raise the question of the amount of military spending, the amount that we're spending on things like keeping hundreds of military bases open around the world, extending these longest wars in U.S. history. These are some of these high-tech weapon systems that the Pentagon doesn't even want, but they're kept funded because they fall in some important congressman's district. You know, these are the kinds of questions that we need to be asking, because those are places where we have huge opportunities to cut spending in a way that would benefit us, rather than cut spending for the things that we actually need, like investments in the green energy economy and jobs and rebuilding our infrastructure. So I think we need to really contend in that discussion, in that spending cut question. You know, if we go back to the level of spending in 2006, you know, that's what was in the sequestration, military spending in 2006, and people were talking about that as though it would be a disaster. It would not be a disaster. The U.S. is spending more on the military than the next, I don't know if it's 10 or dozen countries combined, including most of our allies and most of our so-called enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So we simply have got to step back from this brink of economic as well as military disaster and say, what should our posture actually be in the world, and why should we be bankrupting our country to pay for it?
Austerity is another issue I'd love to talk about in just a moment, but first let's take this call from Judy. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. I was calling you because one thing that concerns me, and I don't hear very much about it, is the problem of all the people that we have in prison today, and the fact that we're finally recognizing this is costing a fortune, and they want to let these people out of prison. And I feel that, you know, if they're let out, you can't just let them out on the street. They have to have job training. They have to have jobs. Otherwise, we're going to see our crime rates really skyrocketing. Does anybody have any thoughts on this?
Thanks very much for your call, Judy.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree with you that the notion that having over 2 million people behind bars in this country, the highest percentage and the highest number of any country in the world, that is somehow a good thing. I agree with you that we've made some, that the U.S. has made some huge mistakes in doing that. And by the way, a lot of that has been, especially recently, has been because the private prison industry has been so effective at getting draconian sentencing laws passed.
Absolutely.
That then succeed in filling up their private prisons and making them a lot of profits. So this is really a bad approach.
And I think that cannot be emphasized enough. If people really want to wrap their minds around this, there is a for-profit prison system where public money, our money, is used to benefit private corporations who are lobbying for draconian laws to imprison us longer so they can get more of our money. It's a cycle that just makes your head spin when you really start thinking about it. And again, to emphasize, because I still run into people who look at me and raise an eyebrow like they have not heard this before. So to emphasize one more time that the U.S. is the global leader in incarceration, that we have more people in prison than any other country in the world per capita. And that is huge. We need to focus on that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sarah.
But the caller did ask a really important question, yeah, which is that what happens when people who have been locked up, brutalized, not given job training, not given an education, and then are just released onto the streets? And yes, that's a really problematic situation for them because they're going to have a difficult time finding employers who will hire them. And it's a difficult situation for the community because the communities don't have the resources to support them in that transition either. We actually did an entire issue on this topic back in the summer of 2011. It's issue number 58, and you can find it on the yesmagazine.org website. It really looks at how do we take on this issue from the beginning to end? How do we keep juveniles from being diverted from school into the prison system? Once people are in prison, what could happen that could prepare them for life on the outside? And once they're on the outside, what are some of the best means of transitioning them back into the community? So it's a huge question, it's more than I think we can take on in this conversation, but I do recommend that issue because we really tried to look at some of the best solutions for looking at it from front to back.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. I do want to remind people that this is Positively Revolting. You can like us on Facebook. If you use Facebook, you can continue the conversation with myself and Lynn and the whole community. They're at our fan page. You can like us, Positively Revolting, on Facebook, or you can also always be in touch with us via email by emailing positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Leah Maka is on the line. Good morning, Leah Maka.
Good morning, you guys. Haven't talked to you for quite a while.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you.
Thank you. I am a regular reader of Yes Magazine, and I keep them all just that I can. And, Sarah, I'd like to know more about where to find your articles if they're not in Yes Magazine. But I wanted to quickly tell you what I'm doing, what's on my plate for the rest of my life. I turned 70 this year, and I looked around and said, okay, I need to find out what it is I want to commit to for the rest of whatever time I have. And what I looked at was two things. One is food security, and the second was I've been working with the veterans off and on for a number of years, and I've decided that where I want to commit my time and energy is against war, and I want to do it through the veterans that are coming home and the healing process. I believe that the skills we have and what we're learning about healing them and moving them, you know, away from the PTSD is also an opportunity to address the issues of war, no more war. And the Iraq Veterans Against War, many of them are coming home, and I listen to Michael Mead and go to his workshops, and what I hear is when the soldiers come home and start really getting healed, they realize that they don't want to do this anymore. So that's where I'm going to spend my time and energy, and Yes Magazine will be on my plate. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Leah Maka.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. And to answer your first question, my articles are always on yesmagazine.org. They're always on the homepage when they're first posted, and then the archive is under my blog. You can just do a search for my name in the search field. But I appreciate the question. And yeah, I think you're really onto something with that question of healing the veterans and the really involving them in the whole question of their healing and how that's related to our social healing. One of the things I was really struck by when I've heard stories from men of their own challenges, whether or not they're veterans, a lot of times they've come out of their relationships with their fathers, and a lot of the times those fathers, I think, were from their description, were men who had PTSD from previous wars, but they were not diagnosed. They were not given an opportunity to heal, and yet that trauma really prevented them from having the relationships with their sons that they might have wanted and that their sons desperately wanted. So I think it is an intergenerational issue, you know, when a whole generation of people is traumatized, that can't help
absolutely.
But affect their children. And that then ripples out to our entire culture. So I think that's very important work.
And I absolutely agree with that and wonder, I mean, I know many people in you know, my generation and slightly younger who were raised by returning Vietnam vets and how that had affected their lives. And looking at that and just seeing the social implications as that ripples out from each war, you know, how we are passing along our damage and how we are really in this society all in need of some healing and some deep work around PTSD issues. Just overall. I want to welcome Tomas to the program. Good morning, Tomas. You're on the line.
Hello, Ani. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
I'm not sure that I came into the program about halfway through, so I'm not sure exactly what the question is that you all have been discussing. But I did want to address some things that I heard. I thought I heard when I first turned on one person talking about a democratic economy, and then another person called and talked about B corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked up B corporations, and it sounds like an interesting idea, but I mean, unfortunately, from the way that I've read about it, I mean, it sounds basically just like putting kind of a pretty face on capitalism, and it's not democratic. I mean, it still puts power in the hands of a CEO and a bunch of people who are likely going to be very wealthy. And are still directed by shareholders who are also likely to be wealthy, and doesn't have any decision making, but doesn't put any decision making power in the hands of workers, which is the fundamental problem of capitalism and giving, you know, having communities be empowered to make decisions for themselves. The workers that work in the factory or in the grocery store or restaurant or whatever don't have any say in how decisions are made, then the community is inevitably going to be negatively affected because people's financial interests are going to be first and foremost, even if they have to take into account the, you know, effects on other aspects.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I'm not very familiar with the concept of a B corporation. It sounds, you know, interesting. I'd like to learn more about it, but I have a real reticence, I suppose, to things that feel to me a little bit like greenwashing. You know, to just sort of put a new, perhaps more positive spin on something without fundamentally changing the structure that is problematic underneath it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much for your call.
Yeah, I would point you to Marjorie Kelly, who's done some amazing work on this question, and there's an article by her which will be coming out in our upcoming issue on the cooperative economy, but we also have an article by her in our issue on how to take on corporate power. And the distinction she makes is who is the owner, and where is the power center, essentially. And if the owners are the workers, the community, the customers, you have a different kind of a dynamic in the works than if the owners are shareholders who are primarily interested in increasing their own monetary position. So I think that's a really interesting distinction, is to just look at who's in charge, who owns it, and who has the power.
Those are very good questions. We only have a couple minutes left. We have one more caller to try to squeeze in. I didn't get to talk about austerity, which I really wanted to do, but, you know, there's shows ahead. Let's talk to Harvey for just one last comment. Good morning, Harvey.
Hi there. Well, I want to tell you about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Just say no to it. It's NAFTA on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership will actually they'll override all local environmental laws. And they'll, for instance, the coal, you want to ship coal through there? Well, this is coal headed for Asia, and they'll override all your environmental laws. It's 600 corporations. This is corporations taking over the world. You can also, you won't be able to use the American label anymore. You'll have to sell off private, you know, you'll have to sell off like private, you know, like the commons, like if the town owns a power plant, you'd have to sell it off. So this is, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is Portland's biggest enemy, because it'll actually smooth the way for the coal trains to go through. So this is the one that has to be fought all the way.
Harvey, I'm so glad that you squoze that in there at the end. I do think that this is a huge, huge issue that we need to take on full front this coming year, like right about now. You're right. It is like NAFTA on steroids. It's a lot like what we have battled against with the WTO. Sarah, your take on the TPP?
I completely agree with you.
Okay. There we have it. So, again, much more to come on that issue in programs ahead. And we just have a couple of moments left. Any last words on really where how we do this together more effectively with more joy, Sarah?
Yeah, I guess I would just point to the idea of appreciative inquiry, which is the notion of figuring out what works by looking at what is working and then building on it. And we've got some real powerful things to build on, I think, in 2013. Those are the sorts of things we look at in Yes Magazine all the time, is we're really looking for, you know, where is people power working? Where are people actually able to make the kinds of shifts that we want to make? Where are people taking on the climate crisis? And how can we build on the things that are already working? How can we get involved in it and give it more attention and more energy? And, you know, that's where I think a lot of our shifts will come from. I don't think anybody, certainly not Yes Magazine, is going to dream up what a new society should look like. But when we look at what people throughout the world and throughout the United States are doing at the grassroots, and look at how we can give that more energy and more power, mm-hmm. then I think we can see where a new society can take form.
Sarah Van Gelder, thank you so very much for joining me this morning on Positively Revolting here on KBOO Community Radio. We very much appreciate your work and appreciate the fact that you took some time for us.
Great. And you can find more, basically all of our articles at yesmagazine.org. And we invite you to come on our website, comment, check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and get involved.
All right. Thank you so very much. Take care.
Thank you.
And please do continue to listen to KBOO, your community radio station. Coming up next, we have the APA Compass. We also want to encourage you to like Positively Revolting on Facebook. You can also, again, email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. I'm Ani. And this is it for this week. Do tune in again next week when Lynn returns as the co-host you know and love. Take care and continue to be positively revolting.
Good morning. It's 9 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO is proud to be a media sponsor of An Evening with Dr. Michelle Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm. Into a world I plunge, through my headphones, escape into the streetlight. I begin to believe in destiny when my...
Good morning and Happy New Year from all of us here at APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, and today we're taking a look back at some of our favorite stories from 2012 in this, our annual Best of APA Compass show. You'll hear interviews with comedian Hari Kondabalu and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jose Antonio Vargas, as well as a performance of Race Monologues by Golden Salazar and Musa Ahmed. We'll also feature one of our favorite Angry APA Minutes of the Year from APA Compass Collective member Sarika Mehta, and a new Angry APA Minute from me, because let's face it, there's always something, right? First up, Andrew Ye's interview with Kyung Ung, whose book, Golden Leaf, discusses his experiences as a survivor of the Khmer Rouge genocide.